You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Iowa's preliminary unemployment rate dropped to 2.6% in July, and that ties it with South Dakota for the second lowest rate in the nation. Iowa Workforce Development said in a news release on Friday the rate was an 18-year low. Hawaii had the nation's lowest rate last month at 2.1%. Iowa's July rate compares to a national rate of 3.9% last month. However, the leader of the Iowa Democratic Party is not convinced that everyone who needs a job or job training is getting it. Tory Price is the executive director of the Iowa Democratic Party. He's been traveling around the state telling Iowa voters Republican reductions on Iowa workforce development and other policies are hurting employers' ability to fill jobs. Last Friday morning, Price was in Sioux City speaking at the Woodbury County Democratic Party office. Price said in 2010, 260,000 Iowans used workforce development offices. That number dropped to 160,000 a number of years later, coinciding with the decision by then-Governor Terry Branstad to close 36 of the state's 55 workforce development field offices, replacing them with computer kiosks. However, by 2017, Des Moines Register reporters found the kiosk system had largely been abandoned. Price also claimed that cuts in education funding, especially to community colleges, has also contributed to the lack of skilled workers. Price said he's been talking about the job training situation in Iowa with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Fred Hubbell.
Well, Fred firmly believes that we got to make sure that our workers have the support they need. I've talked to Fred quite a bit about this over the course of this campaign. And he really wants to make sure that, number one, we're getting these partnerships between employers and employees connected in every community in this state. He wants to make sure that our workforce development offices have the funding that they need, have the resources that they need to make sure that these opportunities exist, that we can restore these opportunities across our state. He also wants to take a look at new ways to try and make sure our workers have the training that they need. So, for example, providing debt-free college to those who, student loan forgiveness for those who enter some of these skilled trades that we really need, making sure that our apprentices have the apprentice programs, have the support that they need. And so, it's really what we are focused on is trying to make sure our workers know that Fred Hubbell's going to go out there and fight for them, that he's going to have their back, unlike what's been happening in Des Moines and in the State House and in the governor's office, that there's going to be a real champion for them in the governor's office after this election this fall.
Price said many of the closed workforce development offices are in rural communities.
And so these are areas of the state where, folks would be able to go and be able to get the help they need, get the resources they need to get to be successful. Now they're having to drive 50 to 100 miles just to find a workforce center across the state. And so it just makes it harder. And these are folks who are struggling out there, who are looking for those opportunities, but they may not have the resources to be able to drive that way. They may not have the resources to be able to connect with their employers or get the training opportunities. And so that's why it is so critically important that we go out there and highlight what has happened out there and make sure folks know that we as Democrats, that Fred Hubbell, Rita Hart, and Democratic legislature will be out there fighting for them to make sure that they actually have those resources.
Price also talked about the job that Governor Kim Reynolds has been doing. He said that Reynolds has not been living up to her promises about workforce development.
Over these last 8 years, we've heard a lot of rhetoric and a lot of talk coming out of the governor's office, coming out from Governor Reynolds, about her support of workers and her support of workforce development in this state. But the rhetoric just doesn't match the reality that Governor Reynolds has made drastic cuts to our workforce centers, closed 36 of them across the state, is underfunding educational opportunities, particularly this Future Ready Iowa program she talks about is only being funded at 5%. That the opportunities that she talks about just simply don't exist because of the fiscal mismanagement of her administration. And that folks need to know that there is someone who is going to go out there and fight for them. There is someone who's going to be able to stand up for them in the governor's office, and that's Fred Hubbell.
Price said he's been hearing from a lot of Iowans who say they're concerned about the problem of creating a well-trained workforce that will choose to stay and live in Iowa.
So we've been on this tour now for a couple of weeks, going out doing a series of either press conferences or roundtables. We've been to Fort Dodge, Mason City. Gosh, where have we been, Sydney? Fort Dodge, Mason City. We've been to Davenport, Cedar Rapids, Washington, Iowa, Boone, Iowa. We've been to quite a few places. And the thing is that everywhere I go, the message is the same, that our workers need support, that our employers need workers. And so the message is universal. And so that's why it is so critically important that these workforce centers are there, that there's funding to help make sure and grow our workforce across the state and support our workers. It's just maddening. It's mind-boggling to me that we continue to make cut after cut after cut after cut to the Workforce Development Office and take that money and start shoveling it to out-of-state corporations. And meanwhile, but there's just such a need out in these communities, particularly in rural parts of the state, such a need for workers and employers to be connected up and for those workers to have the resources they need. But unfortunately, it's not happening. Governor Reynolds has made it clear what her priorities are, and it's not developing our workforce here in Iowa. And so that's why that's what we've been talking about, and that's what we're going to continue to talk about throughout all the way up to election time.
I asked Price about the 7th District State Senate race that's pitting former Woodbury County Supervisor Jackie Smith against two-term incumbent Republican Rick Bertrand. Bertrand had said back in April he wouldn't be running for a third term. However, after candidate Stephen Stokes dropped out, Bertrand was asked by party leaders to step into the gap and run once again. Price said Smith is a strong candidate, and the problems of the Republican Party wouldn't have much of an effect on the election.
I think that whatever the Republican Party, the problems in the Republican Party are the problems within the Republican Party, and they've got many. But their problems are their problems. We as the Democratic Party are going to continue to do what we have to do. And that means just go out there and do the hard work necessary. Democrats have never been afraid of doing the hard work. So we're going to go out there, knock those doors, make those phone calls, talk to voters, and build relationships with voters and do it. We're getting back to basics this cycle. We're really just focused on talking to those folks out there, and that's why I'm confident Jackie Smith's going to win, is because if the Republicans continue to have their challenges, that's fine. We're going to be focused here on here at the Iowa Democratic Party and here in Woodbury County to make sure that we are electing good people like Jackie Smith.
Republicans in Iowa have been lauding the successes they have had in the legislature over the last 2 years, especially with conservative causes. Price said he and other Democrats are working hard in Iowa to try and break the control that state Republicans have in the legislature and in the governor's office.
You know, we have seen what the Republican Party has done with the trifecta here, with the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, and the drastic changes that they have made to this state for the worse. And so we are definitely focused on trying to retake the trifecta again for the Democratic Party so that we can once again start enacting legislation that will help move Iowa forward again, that will help stand up for every Iowan, not just those at the top. And so we are making a concerted effort all across the state to focus on the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, as well as our statewide tickets and our congressional seats, all the way down to courthouse seats, because this year we have a really great opportunity. We have been out working ever since the election of 2016. We've been out working to make sure that voters hear from us and see us, and so now we have a great opportunity to capitalize on that and see success up and down the ticket.
That was Troy Price, the executive director of the Iowa Democratic Party. He was in Sioux City Friday morning as part of a statewide tour of county Democratic offices. 7th District Democratic State Senate candidate Jackie Smith was also at the event on Friday. Smith is a former Woodbury County supervisor. Senate District 7 includes the north and west sides of Sioux City, mainly north of Gordon Drive, and some rural parts of Woodbury County just east of the city limit. Smith served 8 years on the county board, losing her bid for a third four-year term in November 2016 to Republican Keith Raddick. Smith says she's been working hard talking to everyone she can about her goals for that Senate seat.
And I've been hitting doors and talking to folks since April. And I'm into the thousands now of the doors that I've knocked on. And let's take today's topic, for instance, workforce development. And it is so true. I have seen it. People are working. You know, I go to the door. No one's home. There may be toys, you know. And I know they're struggling. You can tell that by the appearance. Sometimes the steps are falling away. The porch is creaky. And it isn't like people are sitting around. I sat on workforce development when I was a county supervisor, and that's when they decided to change from a person to a computer. And I was instrumental. The only thing we could do at that point in time is write a letter. I just said, is that all right with everyone on this board? We know that these are vulnerable Iowans that are looking for jobs. Some of them are non-English speaking. You can't put them into a computer with no assistance and let them, you know, find jobs. So we did take a stand at that point in time. It didn't do any good. The decision had already been made. But, you know, every week I'm just more convinced that a change in leadership is needed, and the people in District 7 are getting shortchanged.
Do you think now that Rick Bertrand is running again, do you think that kind of the shakeup in the party, do you think that might, you know, actually be good for you?
You know, it's hard to say. I know in his farewell speech, he said that if he were around one more year, he may ask for the resignation of Linda Upmeyer, which is the majority leader in the Iowa House. You know, and he asked for resignations within his own party. So it's hard for me to know what he is thinking and why they even recruited him, other than I guess they thought they needed to bring somebody back to beat me. I think they know that I'm a strong candidate and that my message is resonating with the folks in this district, and their message absolutely is missing what is needed.
We talked a lot about workforce development. Are there any other issues you're really, you know, interested in and you get down to Des Moines?
There are. Of course, education resonates well with everyone, and it is the great equalizer. You know, if we can make that system strong, public education strong, community college strong, colleges affordable, apprenticeships. I mean, it's just such a complex problem. Also, there needs to be food on the table for, you know, when the kids go home. There needs to be nutrition. So it really is a community it's a community problem. It's a community opportunity as well for us all to come together and support the people that are living here. I do know I was born and raised in this district. The demographics have changed. You know, people aren't as white, if I may be so honest. And what I do see that's so encouraging is there's community within the neighborhoods. There's people neighboring. In my neighborhood, we don't even hardly neighbor. You know, everyone is busy running their kids to somewhere and working and doing the laundry when they get home. But I see moms and kids talking to each other, and even people running back and forth, like on a Sunday afternoon. And you know what gives me hope? And it reinforces the hard work that we're doing.
That was Democratic 7th District State Senate candidate Jackie Smith talking about why she wants to run for office. The incumbent in that office, State Senator Rick Bertrand, has decided to run once again for that office. This will be a third term for Bertrand. 48-year-old Bertrand was nominated last week by Sioux City Republicans to be on the ballot for that Senate District 7 seat. He announced in March he wouldn't campaign again for the seat, but changed his mind in recent days after GOP nominee Stephen Stokes withdrew from that race, saying he needed to devote more time to his business. In 2016, Bertrand unsuccessfully challenged U.S. Representative Steve King of Chiron in the 4th Congressional District's Republican primary election. Bertrand has said in the past he favored term limits and had concluded that 8 years in the Iowa Senate would be enough. He had said the best ideas by lawmakers are generated during their first few years of service. But when state Republican leaders came to him and asked him to run once again, he felt he needed to do it.
it was a great 8-year run. And I'm, as anyone knows me, I'm a big believer in term limits. And I still believe in term limits. But, you know, situations change. And when the person that was going to run for the seat in the Republican side, Steve Stoltz, when he decided to drop out, it left a vacancy. And it's tough in this environment to find people that will run for office. I mean, with social media the way it is and the venom that's out there, it's really hard to find good people that will put their necks out there and put themselves on a ballot. So at the end of the day, you know, the Senate obviously is Republican controlled, and the party is nervous, obviously, in an election year about losing, not just now, but maybe in 2020. And they reached back and said they would really like to hold this seat. This is a tough seat to hold for Republicans. And they asked me, said, would you consider? And I said, no, I think, I mean, I had some other things that I was eyeing, and I kind of moved back into my personal life. But when local community business leaders start reaching out, when the governor reaches out to you, and when Senate leadership, all of a sudden now they're asking you. And I started to think to myself, going, this is good for Sioux City. We start talking about committee assignments, and, you know, it's all about leverage and building capital. And I think that this is a great opportunity for Sioux City to hold this seat. And if I go back there, as anyone knows, that I work for Sioux City. I like to drag things home. And so, again, I just said I'd do it. Here we are.
I know that from what I've read, that the voting patterns in the district are 37% Democrat and 30% Republican, so it's not an easy thing.
Yeah, I mean, as people know, I was the first Republican in 30 years to hold this seat, to win this seat, and the first one in over probably almost 50 years to be reelected. But at the end of the day, what I've learned also, too, is that Sioux City has kind of evolved over the years. And if you really look at the largest base that we have is independents. Independents outnumber Republicans and Democrats combined. So at the end of the day, I think that we're still right-centered when it comes to independents. People still understand it's all about the economy and it's about jobs. People know I'm a working guy. They know that I invest in Sioux City. I work here. My family grows up here. And I think they recognize that when I go down to Des Moines, I'm a voice. I play a little rough. I'm not going to lie. People over the years know that I play rough for Sioux City. But I also drag things home. And I understand my goals are very, very clear when I go to Des Moines. My job is to represent Sioux City and to bring things home. And I think over the years, when it comes to Highway 20 or it comes to some of the targeted jobs program that does some equalization with South Dakota, we've done a good job of bringing things home.
Jackie Smith seems to be making part of her campaign that you've missed votes.
Yeah. You know, they tried that 4 years ago, and it's an old Democratic playbook. You know, we're a community-based legislature, and we miss votes. But again, I always go back to, and I said 4 years ago, and they run the same campaign again at other candidates across the state. I always say is point to a vote that impacted Sioux City that I missed. And you can go back to Al Sturgeon, Steve Hansen, and Warrenstead, and even our own Chris Hall. We miss votes. That's just part of being a community-based legislature. You know, Chris Hall missed, and I love Chris, but, you know, he missed the education reform vote. He missed the commercial property tax vote. Nobody talks about that. So again, I always say that if the goal of my opponent going into this election is to try to convince my neighbors in Sioux City that I'm not committed to Sioux City and I don't work hard, I think that's going to be a pretty hard lift.
Well, you're definitely a conservative. You describe yourself as a conservative, and all of the more conservative moves in the last 2 years you were in support of, for sure.
Well, what's interesting is that what makes me, I feel that I'm an effective legislator for Sioux City, is I laugh as I talk to my wife Tammy about it, is I've made just as many Republicans mad back here as I've made Democrats, which tells me that I'm doing something right, as I'm representing, I think, the city as a whole. Some of the things like representing IPERS. I'm a big supporter as a Republican, one of the only Republicans that supports the IPER system. I don't think it should be changed. I think it works. I think it's solvent. And I think in the last couple of years, when that issue has come up in our caucus, in the Republican caucus, I have been a voice, and not just a voice, but someone that's led on this. So last year when it came up, maybe possibly changing IPERS, it was January 23rd, I filed Senate Joint Resolution 2002, which really requires a two-thirds majority in the Senate to do any changes to the IPERS program. Now, people say, why is that significant? That gave cover to some of my Republican colleagues. The discussion ended right there with changing IPERS. So again, I always tell my friends, my teacher friends, my cops, and people that are on IPERS, city workers, that if I believe in it, I support it, and I put my money where my mouth is.
Yeah, IPERS has been a solid system. It's one of the most solid in the country, actually, right?
Yeah, and we need people on both sides talking about it. And what my resolution did is it brought awareness to it that not one party in control, Republican or Democrat, should have the ability to make knee-jerk reactions or changes to these type of programs. We saw that kind of with the Medicaid transformation. I mean, when one party kind of makes these big knee-jerk reactions, the pendulum swings pretty quick. So, again, strong supporter of IPERS, and I will continue to be that voice down in Des Moines for it.
How do you feel about all the issues going on with the privatized system? Do you think that there need to be some adjustments made, or what those might be?
Yeah, you know, it takes time, and I understand that when you're taking a large population that is not used to this type of a system to make that transition. I do think there are some horrendous stories and some stories out there about doctors and about reimbursements, or the big things that I hear a lot about is just clinics and doctors not getting paid and not be able to get the service out there. So, but I think what we're seeing is those bumps are being smoothed out. I think that the governor has done a good job of trying to make a hybrid system now work. Can there be changes? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, I think the goal was sincere, which was cost savings and to provide more services.
When you talk to people and you're out, you know, at gatherings, what are some of the issues they tell you, you know, gosh, I really would like you to look at this or work on this?
You know, I hear a lot about, it really is still always about the economy for me. And I know the last year or two, you know, when I kind of was in the twilight of my terms, I focused on some of more of the issues that were important to me when it came to the Second Amendment, when it comes to life and those type of things. But at the end of the day, people know that I'm down there on a Sioux City economic agenda. So what I hear when I'm in Walmart or I'm walking around Target or if I'm in Menards, people come up to me and the number one issue they talk about is how the economy is doing locally, the things that we're doing to compete against South Dakota, or, you know, funding for school is always an important thing, you know, renewing the save penny. So those are things that are out there that are real issues to people. And I think at the end of the day, when you talk to people individually, they understand I represent Sioux City. They know I'm working hard. And I think that we really have a voice down there.
I remember last year, I think it was in December when they had that meeting with the legislators, the city, the county, and the legislators. A lot of the talk was about tax reform, about the getting the backfill payments, and very much about the economic health of the city and the county. And I think that that sort of showed up in the legislature.
Well, I think I'm proud to say this, and I mean this humbly, but I'm very proud to say this, that from an effectiveness standpoint, when the city has put something in front of us, I've responded. I mean, I don't care if it was Highway 20, you know, that's the big bite. They said it couldn't be done. We went out and made the tough vote, made some Republicans mad when we did it with some of the gas tax issues. But at the end of the day, we cut the deal and we got it done, and it's going to be completed on October 19th. Other things when it comes to the targeted job program, which then gives us equalization with South Dakota. Another thing that people don't understand is when I sat on the RIF committee, which is basically the subcommittee that controls the gaming dollars, the revenues. We send a lot of dollars to Des Moines. And again, it goes unnoticed, but the city, we've got this whole I-29 utilities revitalization. I was able to bring home basically a blank check for $1.5 million last year. That's stuff that doesn't get seen, but that's my job. And this is why I think that some of the Senate leadership in the last few years became upset with me, because they saw that we were effective and that Sioux City had a voice, and we were getting things done.
Do you think there'll still be this wide, seems like a big divide between the Democrats, the leadership of the Democrats, the leadership of the Republicans, always sort of like going head to head on the issues over and over again?
You know, I kid around about this too, and I know that people have heard this before, but we really do agree on the majority of things. I think it used to be said that, you know, you agreed 9 out of 10 things you agreed on. Now maybe it's 7 out of 10. But for the most part, you know, you would do work in a bipartisan way down there to pass the budget. You're not always going to agree on everything. I do think that the parties have become polarized. There's no doubt about it that we've kind of run to the corners. And I think that comes with, we talked about before, the social media aspect of it, the 24-hour news cycle. It's just always in front of us, and it keeps that kind of that flame hot. Before, if you had a disagreement, you know, it had a cooling off period. You know, it cooled off in the saucer. Now, with the way social media is and this 24-hour news cycle, it just keeps that flame hot at all times. And I can tell you, putting your name on a ballot now is a lot harder than it was putting your name on a ballot 8 years ago, because there's just so many avenues at you to attack you. And the problem is that when you're attacked, you don't really have any venue to respond. And that's really frustrating for me at times.
I think two of the biggest issues in the last year have been Second Amendment issues, gun safety, gun versus gun rights, which maybe shouldn't be a versus situation, and abortion.
Yeah.
And that has probably caused the most controversy.
Yep. And those are, again, those are issues that, again, will continue to always be out there. It's a clear divide in the country. And I think now it's just about which side motivates their people at this point in time in history. So again, I think the good news is that I've always been seen as someone that goes down there, is not afraid to break party when it comes to budgets or when it comes to other issues, and I'll continue to do that as I move forward. You know, I've just been really proud of this community, and the support that we get and the support that I feel when I go down there, I always enjoy when people drive over from Sioux City, if it's the realtors or if it's the chamber or whoever it is, they come over, and I think they get a good glimpse of how hard it really is over there to get something done for this side of the state. But we've got a great group of legislators over here. I wish my good friend Bill Anderson was still down there. We worked really hard together. But Jim Carlin's doing a great job. And it's nice having two Republicans headed that way because we can put some common sense for Northwest Iowa back into the dialogue.
And that was Republican incumbent State Senator Rick Bertrand of Sioux City, who has decided to run in November's election for a third term. He's taking on Democratic candidate Jackie Smith for the District 7 State Senate seat. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. While the kids are back at school this week after a few months' summer vacation, some are excited to go back, others are not. Part of the problem could be boredom with materials and outmoded textbooks. That's what sociologist James Lowen posits in the 20th anniversary edition of his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. The book is one of the most successful history books of our time, challenging some well-worn assumptions about American history. This edition has a new preface that shows how inadequate high school history courses can be. Lowen says textbooks are important, but by far not the only material that should be used in a history course.
And you can teach history using the book. Sometimes you have to teach history by teaching against the book when the book is wrong. Sometimes you have to teach history by teaching by going beyond the book because the book has almost nothing in it on a given subject. I'll give you an example of that. Several of the textbooks are just terrible on the question of how and when did people first get to the Americas, which is, of course, the very first issue in an American history course. None of these textbook authors know anything about archaeology and anthropology. They're just consumers of it, just like you or I am. And they aren't good consumers. That is, they're not up on the amazing new ideas that are sweeping the field of archaeology and anthropology and have been for the last 10 years. More classroom time and more study time is spent with the huge textbooks than any other subject. Now, that's just terrible.
Do you have any specific advice for teachers?
Oh, yeah. And advice is all over the place in my books. But I have to say the very first thing that they need to do, and I know this is self-serving, but let's put it this way. Don't buy lies, my teacher told me. Make the library buy it, the school library, and then you read it first. And then you didn't have to buy it. Okay? I'm not trying to sell the book. I'm trying to sell people to read the book. That way, you'll have a leg to stand on at least several topics. You'll know more than the textbook does on at least several topics. So you can get students challenged and learning other stuff than just the boring stuff in the textbook on at least several topics. That'll get you started. I also wrote another book called Teaching What Really Happened. That's published by Teachers College Press, and it's specifically aiming at K-12 teachers. So, if I might plug that book, buy it, read it. And if you're a parent, you might buy it and read it, but keep it nice. Don't take any notes in it. Take notes on a separate piece of paper, and then give it to the history teacher that is teaching your kid in high school.
Do you think that, considering how much time, especially you know, younger people spend online and digital sources and podcasting and streaming things. Do you think that might be a better way to go, a good way to go with this? Because I talked to so many adults who say, I learned more about history listening to podcasts in the last few years than I ever learned in high school.
Yeah. Well, of course, it's easy to learn more than you ever did in high school, because I think what the American teenager has learned to do, and I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, is to devote a certain number of synapses to useless twigs in American history. I mean, we're not teaching forests or even trees. We're teaching twigs, you know, isolated factoids. And after you learn the 55 twigs that are called for the test in this unit, then you clear that area of the synapses to make room for the next unit. And finally, in June, you clear them one more time and you got an A- and you didn't learn anything. Wait a minute. I think that was a rant. to get serious in answering to your question, that's true. And that's one reason why I argue that the day of the 1150-page textbook is over. The 1150-page textbook made sense maybe in 1965 when we're in a tiny little town, let's say Manning, Iowa, not too far from you, and it doesn't hardly have a library, and it doesn't hardly have a high school library, especially it didn't back then. So it doesn't have much resources for American history other than the textbook. But that's not the case anymore. Manning, Iowa, and every other Iowa high school and town is connected to electricity and connected to the internet. And so they've got all kinds of resources available. So the issue now is, how do you read them? How do you assess them? We need to help students learn. There's a lot of teachers in a lot of school districts that are kind of afraid to deviate from the textbook. What's going to happen? First, you have to bring your principal along. You have to tell him or her why you're teaching 30 to 50 subjects, why this is what colleges want, why this is what students want, why it's going to be more better. There we go. And you have to do it well. But you can do it. And indeed, when you do, your students will start liking your course much better than they did before. And even if Parent X is offended by, say, your treatment of why the Civil War occurred, you're going to be able to fend them off, because the students, including Parent X's own children, are going to be liking your course better than they ever did before. And very few parents come in and complain and say, when I was a student, I hated history, and for some reason, you're making it interesting. So go for it. It'll work, and your students will thank you for it.
That was sociologist James Lowen talking about his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Teacher Got Wrong. That book has sold more than 2 million copies since it was published 20 years ago. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Multimedia artist Barry Phipps never thought he would call himself an Iowan, but a job offer for his wife at the University of Iowa led him to Iowa City, and it revitalized his photography. His photographic inquiries into the nature of small-town Iowa have been collected in the book Between Gravity and What Cheer? Iowa Photographs. Phipps says his Iowa photography project was born after he got a flat tire on a trip back from Galena to Iowa City. He stopped in Dubuque to get his tire changed, and he started taking pictures. Once he was on the road again, he found himself turning down various roads and taking photographs of things along the way, and he went on other trips as well. And so you got in the car and you started taking these road trips, and how did you decide where you wanted to go?
Well, yeah, I mean, first I just started kind of taking short trips kind of in every direction from Iowa City. Iowa City being an older city and the former capital, it's just kind of like this hub of all these old highways that intersect through Iowa City. So just about in every direction, you can kind of spoke out on one of those spokes and take a road trip. So how did I decide? Well, the earliest trips were just pretty much about how far could I go and come back in one day. But yeah, once I decided that this was more than just road trips and taking photos and it's starting to become more of a bigger project, then I started taking trips for different reasons.
Sometimes you would go to towns just because of their names. They're such interesting names.
Yeah, that was definitely part of it. Towns like Gravity, Wetchear, Diagonal, Mingo. I mean, there's just all these towns with really interesting names. So yeah, a lot of times it would just be kind of like, well, let's go to that town and see what's there, and kind of making a trip around that. Another way I kind of decided how to do things was on one of the first trips I took, I bought a Iowa road map and a Sharpie marker and just started marking up the map as I went along to kind of keep track of where I had been. And once this became, like I said, a bigger project and was going to develop into a book, then I started looking at that map going, well, I really need to fill in this area here because I haven't even been over here. So a lot of times it was just kind of like, well, if I take this road and go through these towns, that would look really good on the map, you know, and just kind of trying to fill these things out and fill in blanks and things like that.
When you look at these photos, they say a lot about the place they're at, but they also say a lot about, you know, time going by, some of them with paint chipping off sometimes. And the one that I noticed was the one where you've got the lone kid riding his bike down a main street in front of, you know, this store. And it looks so deserted, and here comes this little kid riding his bike.
Yeah, there's quite a bike culture in small towns in Iowa. It seems like all of the kids who live in these small towns ride their bikes through the areas. And so, yeah, a lot of times you would have these kind of just kind of open spaces. And you know, a lot of these towns aren't as abandoned as they sometimes appear to be in my photographs. I tend to favor photographing on the weekends in the business districts when a lot of the places are closed, just to kind of keep my compositions more minimal and be more about the architecture and the textures and all that stuff. But yeah, when a kid starts coming down the street on a bicycle, a lot of times I wait for that kid to pass through the shot before taking the photo, just to kind of add a little movement and life and things like that to the photos.
Now, I know you didn't have an agenda, so to speak, when you started, but I noticed the photo in Sioux City was a photo of Hoff Sporting Goods on Pierce Street downtown. It's one of the old time businesses, and so many businesses are shut down. I couldn't help but think, wow, you know, here this place survives from the olden times when I was growing up, and everything else that was there before has gone or become something else.
Sure. Yeah. I took that the first time I ever went to Sioux City, and it is of that sporting goods store, and it's got a nice turquoise thing going on. But it was also kind of about sort of an ensemble cast of different things in that photo. I liked how that sporting goods store, you know, looked kind of like it was from the 60s, maybe it had this turquoise look. And then on the other side of the street are these really bright orange flower pots that really played against it. And that was another shot where there's a car just driving out of the scene on that, and trying to incorporate that in as well, in the same way what I do with the bicycles, to, you know, give a sense that these streets are, you know, a little less trafficked than, say, Chicago, but not completely abandoned. But yeah, I guess I'm looking for layers of time and looking for layers of sort of accumulations that happen. And that's something I see more in Iowa than I did when I was in Chicago. In Chicago, it seems like because the demand on real estate is so high, things are torn down before preserved and, you know, a lot of things like that. Whereas in smaller towns and some cities in Iowa, the old things remain and new things kind of pop up alongside them. So you end up having these layers of time that really interest me. And that was one of those things with that Sioux City photo that interests me, is sort of like the layers of time.
And the photo of the Made Right sign all chipping off, and how, you know, Made Rights were such a big part of Iowa culinary history.
And there's still some around, which is great. And I've photographed them all, and I've been shooting a short film as well. And I've been going into some of those locations, and Canteen Lunch in the Alley, I was just there and just asking them if I can make a short film of them, you know, doing their operation and stuff. And yeah, that kind of loose meat sandwich that Made Right was famous for, Canteen Lunch in the Alley in Ottumwa, and does that as well. And that's something I never had until I moved to Iowa. And it's really great because they can make you one of those sandwiches in like 30 seconds.
Yeah, they can.
I'm kind of amazed, and they're so good. The first time I ever had those was actually at the canteen lunch in Ottumwa, and they plop one of those down in like 30 seconds, and I ate it, and I was just like, please give me another one. I ended up eating three of them. They're so delicious.
So you're working in film. You're taking photos. You studied art. You're really connecting a lot of the dots of.
Yeah, I'm kind of a multimedia artist. I've always done a lot of different things. And even though I do a lot of things that seem unrelated, I think a lot of art disciplines relate to one another. And I kind of look at it as everything really comes down to composing with color, line, texture, form, and kind of like cultural signifiers. All those things exist in music and in recording music and in filmmaking and photography, in painting and sculpture, in performance art, installation. They're kind of all related. But I've taken all these different things I've done over 30 years and tried to apply them to any discipline I'm working in. So I think my photography really relates to my experiences I had. I ran a recording studio in Chicago for a decade.
Unlike sometimes when people come to Iowa with a certain agenda, sometimes it's like, look at all the beautiful scenery and the beautiful old-timey things, or look at the despair of rural Iowa, of rural America. It's sort of nice to see something that doesn't go on like a one-note path.
Yeah, you know, I was really careful. You know, I grew up in the Midwest, actually lived in Southern California through third grade, and then both of my parents, who were Midwesterners, returned. And so I ended up settling down in Southern Missouri in the Ozarks, and I have a connection to Midwestern life. And even back then, I think we moved back in 79, there was already kind of a decline going on in the small town of Rogersville, Missouri, where I grew up. And just kind of seeing the old general store Pickerings that, you know, they had old Levi's and it was a general store and they sold groceries and everything else. And seeing that kind of close down because people were opting to go to the JCPenney's and the Sears in the big city, you know, versus buying things local because they had to pay a little bit more money. And so I'm sensitive to that. But, and also, you know, in Iowa, I think it was even more so than Missouri, that having the farm crisis really, you know, affect all these things. But I was really careful not to really focus so much on the decline and the decay and the despair and the economic upheaval that happened, and really just focus more on what's there now and what can I make with it. And you know, I'm not really into negativity much. And so, you know, I think there's a need for that in art to criticize and critique. But I'm more interested in finding what's beautiful in any situation that's there and trying to make something from that rather than focus on the, you know, the negative impacts that it's had.
So do you think you're going to be an Iowan for a while? Do you see yourself hanging around?
Yeah, we're here for good. yeah. And this project that I've kind of called it Iowa Photographs, and it sort of morphed, the first 4 years of the project morphed into the book. But I never intended to really stop this project. And I kind of like the idea of working within the limitations of the state boundaries. You know, the state boundaries are kind of arbitrary in a sense. It's not like the landscape or culture changes much as you go over these borders, you know, at least not at first. But I just really like the idea of spending the rest of my life focusing on this state and what's within it. And hopefully having time over the next 30 years to see what changes from the first things that I photographed that are in this book now.
That was multimedia artist Barry Phipps. His book is called Between Gravity and What Cheer, Iowa Photographs. Thank you. You're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. The Exchange is brought to you in part by Gregory Giles, an investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City. Legacy has been serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. More information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at 712-587-8070. Securities offered through United Planners Financial Services, member FINRA SIPC. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. And you're listening to Siouxland Public Media, The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett, and we're hearing some music right now from the Vibrations. They are going to be one of the bands you can hear this weekend at Sioux City Brewfest. I'm here with Steve Smith in Studio A.
Well, hello, Mary. How are you?
I'm getting there.
It's been a good show so far.
There you go.
Hoping the first annual. I guess anytime you have a first event, you call it the first annual. It seems optimistic to me, but I'm hoping that they're able to pull this off. It's a successful event. You played Vibrations going into this segment, and it's going to kind of culminate with them with their CD release party. So they've been working hard for a couple of years now as a band, a working band in Sioux City, and they're putting out a CD at this party. But the whole festival is going to be just a lot of fun.
Yeah, and so we're going to have all sorts of different things going on there, though, right?
Right. Well, okay, so it's the Brew Fest. So Brew City is a brewery which has a kind of a microbrewery, small batch brewery that just kind of took up space in Marty's Tap, the longtime bar on Court Street there.
Right.
And they've been, I think, in business for about 7 months. Adrian Colbo, last month in July, was talking to the head brewer at Brew City, Matt Hubert, and this was the first that I'd heard of this this Brew City event.
Right, yeah, first annual Brew Fest. It's at Marty's Tap. It's going to be out in the parking lot. We're going to have like 10 bands perform, so it's the CD release party for Vibrations. They're the final show for the night. And we start off with yoga at noon with some music.
Yoga at noon.
Yeah. Well, what beer festival would be complete without yoga?
These days, none. It's everywhere.
It's a very bohemian type of festival. As Matt mentioned, Grace Clays, who's used to be the drummer for kind of a heavy rock band in Sioux City, Port Nocturnal, she's doing her own solo thing now. She's doing some really interesting music, and she's going to be accompanying the yoga, because now yoga needs music.
It does.
So that's going to happen at
coffee,
noon.
Everything. Dogs.
Exactly. It's going to be a great time. So Mace Vollmer will be leading that yoga class, Her Grace playing music. And then Devin Cadwell.
Oh, Devin.
He of Devin Cadwell's Favorite Food fame,
yeah,
will be getting things underway at 2 o'clock. Devin, singer-songwriter. We've heard him before he started hosting his radio program here. Come on and do his acoustic stylings, and that'll be at 2 o'clock. This is interesting. Out of Fort Dodge, it's Rowan McCartney's Irish Review. Ooh. So they're going to be playing Irish drinking songs, which I guess is super-duper appropriate for a beer festival.
Exactly.
Mace Hathaway, that's our second Mace of the day, in case you're keeping score.
Yeah, I was going to say. I've not heard two in a day ever.
Right, yeah.
Outside of a cooking class.
Well, that's what the Sioux Brewfest is all about.
There you go.
He's an acoustic folk soul musician out of Omaha. Thin Mistress, which is the acoustic version of the hard rock band Thick Mistress.
Yeah, I like that.
It's Thick Mistress playing acoustic instruments. They'll be on at 5 o'clock. A progressive band out of Lamar's, Winter Wayfarer, who has performed here in Studio A before. They're going to be at 7. Diego Danger, I don't know anything about them. They're out of Central Iowa, the blues rock band. The Ruralists, also good friends of us here at
Siouxland
Public Media.
They're great, yeah. And Ghost Cat. Yeah. We love Ghost Cat.
Yeah, Ghost Cat and the Ruralists. I think we have some music from the Ruralists, don't we?
Just
to give people a little sample of their Americana music of the Ruralists.
Here we go.
Mm-hmm. So like you said, after the Ruralists, then it's going to be Ghost Cat on stage at 10 o'clock. Another really exciting band at 11 o'clock. It's Artificial Stars. They are exciting because they're pretty new. They won the Battle of the Bands at the Marquee back last spring. And then earlier this summer, they won the Battle of the Bands at the Hard Rock. So they're a big up-and-coming band. And wrapping it up with Vibrations, the CD release party, at midnight. And we're going to head out with them. It's all getting underway at noon Saturday at Marty's Tap. It's the first annual Sioux City Brewfest.
And thank you so much, Steve. And that's Brewfest this Saturday afternoon at Marty's Tap in Sioux City, hosted by Brew City Brewing and Aorta Music and Management. And that's it for this edition of The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.